38. The Apprentice.
I'm not sure I can recommend visiting the Spore Seas. While there are places in the Cosmere that are more deadly, few are so casually dangerous. Other locations will kill you with a roar or a cataclysm, but the Spores, they do it with a whisper. One moment you're enjoying a nice book, the next you take in an unfortunate breath, get a few crimson spores in your system, and suddenly you've turned your skull into a colander. It doesn't happen often, but when it does, it seems somehow more unfair than dying from a lightning bolt or a hurricane. Nature is supposed to announce herself before murdering you. It's only sporting. That said, the Spore Seas do have some sights to sell. Fort made room for Tress by the prow, sending a couple of dogs to watch from the rigging instead. It was evening, and this far away from the Lunagree, the green dome of the verdant moon drooped low on the horizon behind them, a mirror image to the crimson one ahead, a vast red sphere in the sky peeking over the horizon with the sun hovering above it like an eager sibling. Closer to the ship, just ahead, the verdant spores gradually mixed with the crimson, making a gradient where, from a distance, the center was a deep brown. The vibrant, shimmering red beyond seemed an ocean of blood, like the crimson moon had been shot, and the crow's song was sailing toward its corpse. Tress hadn't given thought to how wrong that color would feel. The emerald moon and sea had quite literally colored everything she'd ever seen. It intimidated her to realize she was leaving it and entering that wounded red ocean instead. She'd been watched by the verdant moon all her life, and a very small piece of her, irrational though it was, worried she'd vanish the moment it stopped thinking about her. As they closed the distance, then crossed the border, Fort leaned against the railing and held up his sign.
"You're grinning."
"Sorry," Tress said. "It's just that this is terrifying."
"You smile when things are terrifying?"
"I didn't used to," she said. "I think my brain is intimidated by how insane things are out here on the seas, and is trying to fit in."
Fort rubbed his chin, but didn't write anything else. She knew he was thinking about her supposed role as a king's mask, and how she wasn't nearly as frightened of spores as she should have been. And again, it wasn't that. She was afraid. At the same time, she hadn't realized how terribly beautiful those red spores would be, nor how strange it would feel to be leaving the Emerald Sea. These were new emotions, and like new flavors, they could be simultaneously terrifying and intoxicating. What else would she have never known about herself if she hadn't left her home island? Worse, how many people like her lived in ignorance, lacking the experience to fully explore their own existence? It is one of the most bitter ironies I've ever had to accept. There are, unquestionably, musical geniuses of incomparable talent who died as street sweepers because they never had the chance to pick up an instrument. The crow's song continued straight on into the Crimson Sea until one of the dogs in the rigging called out a warning. The sky had opened up, and death was snaking toward them. Tress had never seen rain before. On her island, water came from wells. Though she'd been told about water falling from the sky, it had always felt magical, mystical, a thing of stories. One of those stories apparently wanted to eat her, for the rain came streaking straight toward them, a knot of fast-moving clouds in the sky, trailing an explosion of aether in a line upon the ocean, a vast wall of crimson spikes that grew up and locked together with such force the clacking sound was audible from a great distance. Tress stood mesmerized. Soleil, fortunately, had more experience here, and was already turning the ship when the captain called out an order to do so. They veered hard, tacking to port and swerving, lethargically, back into the verdant. The rain line didn't give chase, though it did turn upon the border of the seas, racing on ahead, leaving interlocking crimson spines 30 feet tall. Those eventually slumped and sank into the sea, leaving it pristine, calm.
like a child who stuffed the broken cookie jar under the counter and assumed all would be forgotten.
Moons, Tress breathed. What if the seethe had stilled right then? What if we'd been unable to move?
Fort glanced at his board to read what she'd said. His only response was to shrug. It was the sort of risk they would take, sailing the Crimson.
Tress turned toward the quarterdeck where Crow stood near the helm station, taking a long pull on her canteen. She lowered it and seemed thoughtful. She wouldn't dare press forward, would she, with that rain line slithering through the region?
Helmswoman,
Crow finally said, projecting her voice so everyone could hear.
Kindly take us south a spell along the border. It seems imprudent to enter the Crimson at the moment.
As you command, Captain, Saleh said.
Crow swooped down to the main deck, then slammed herself into her cabin. Laggart hurried down the steps, nearly stumbling in his haste, then quickly covered the slip by shouting for the Dugs to get back to work. In minutes, they were sailing a leisurely course along the border. Fort excused himself to go scrub some pots, leaving Tress leaning against the ship's rail. Laggart stumped past Tress, then hesitated.
You, he said. What do you think of this now?
I honestly don't know, she replied. I'm still trying to wrap my mind around it all.
I can help with that,
Dr. Ulam's voice called from nearby. Laggart grunted. Then he gestured for her to follow. Curious, she joined him on the quarterdeck. Behind the helm and the captain's roost was the aft cannon, set out on its own railed platform like a heavily reinforced balcony, sticking out the very back of the vessel. It was a dangerous section of the ship, as it was away from the silver protections. Spores that somehow leaped the gap between sea and deck here would take longer to die. That, of course, was important for the Zephyr spores used as charges. Laggart rummaged in the gunnery barrel, an action that fortunately caused him to look down, because if he'd seen Tress's face, he might have noticed her sudden spike of worry. What was he doing? Was he going to confront her with one of the swapped cannonballs?
Moons! She would have made a terrible spy. How could Saleh and the others possibly think she was a king's mask?
Tress didn't understand that it is quite possible to be so bad at something it seems implausible. In these cases, it stands to reason that such a person is in fact quite competent, because it takes true competence to feign such spectacular incompetence. It's called the transitive property of ineptitude, and is the explanation for anything you've seen me do wrong ever. In this case, Tress's transitive ineptitude didn't come into play because Laggart didn't see how nervous she was, nor did he confront her with a fake cannonball. Instead, he selected an ordinary cannonball, then held it up as if admiring a beautiful painting. Or, considering the way his bald head on the end of his toothpick neck made him look, perhaps he was wondering if there was any relation.
Now that we're proper pirates, he said to Tress, I figure we ought to have someone on this ship besides me and the captain who knows how to fire a cannon. The rest of the crew are too useless around spores to be trained. Congratulations.
She noticed that despite his bold words, he reached very gingerly into the gunnery barrel and selected a pouch of Zephyr spores, holding it pinched between two fingers. He quickly loaded it into the cannon through a latch on the top.
Zephyr charge goes in here, he said, snapping the metal lid closed. Get them loaded quickly, because even here the deck's silver is close enough to start killing spores. Inner casing there is lined with aluminum to block the silver's influence.
He pushed a wad into the cannon and rammed it into place with a rod.
This rag fills up the bore of the cannon, he explained. Keeps the explosion from going around the ball, and puts the full force on the shot.
He slid a cannonball down the front of the cannon. It thumped into place.
Cannon can't angle too low, otherwise we'd roll the ball out the front.
All right, Tress said. But, does the captain know you're having me do this?
I'm cannon master, he snapped. Captain won't care who I train. You just do as you're told. Besides, a man needs to take care of himself. I don't want to end up wounded,
then get sunk because nobody else on this damn ship has the guts to handle Zephyr.
So, Laggard didn't know that she was to be sold to the dragon. This struck Tress as odd, since he seemed to know the rest of the plan. But then she realized there was a good chance the captain considered him a backup sacrifice. He was one of the crew members who was least afraid of spores. Laggard picked up a small wooden contraption near the railing, then tossed it overboard. It proved to be a kind of small buoy with a flag, tied by a rope to the ship. As they sailed, it trailed along far behind, like the most conscientious of stalkers.
"Take 5 shots a day, Laggard told her. "The best way to get a feel for a cannon is to practice."
He started to walk away. "Wait," Tress said. "You're not going to give me any more training than that?"
"Training would be useless until you know more," he said. "I'm busy. Figure it out and don't bother me with stupid questions. If you sink a buoy, congratulations. There are more in the hold. Come bother me when you can do it in at most 2 shots, and then we'll talk about some real training."
"All right," Tress said, an idea occurring to her. "But maybe I should start with something less expensive and wasteful than full cannonballs. We don't have a flare gun on board, do we? I could try that out first."
"What kind of a stupid question is that?" Laggard said.
It was identifiably the stupid kind of stupid question, which at least is better than the redundant kind of statement.
"A flare gun is nothing like a cannon," he said. "So just do what I told you, idiot!"
He continued muttering to himself as he stalked off. Tress folded her arms. She'd been planning to spend the evening either studying or trying to figure out how to crack Hoyd's curse. This was an unwelcome intrusion. Still, perhaps there were some advantages. If she was planning to build her own spore-based weapon to fight the captain, there were worse uses of her time than experimenting with a cannon. It was just that Laggard, by refusing to offer any useful training, had ensured she'd waste hours figuring out the basic mechanics of aiming the cannon. Even with this brief delay at the border, she knew her time was short. Depending on where the dragon's den was in the Crimson Sea, she had anywhere between a few hours and a few weeks to plan. A solution occurred to her only a moment later. She pushed the cannon forward, as she'd seen Laggard do. Then she smiled, took a firing rod, which had a soaked bit of cloth on the end, and stuck it into the touch hole. A second later, an explosion rocked her, knocking the cannon back along its track. It took less than a minute for Anne's head to pop up behind, wide-eyed and eager.